Welcome to Hospice Foundation of America's series, Professionally Speaking, featuring conversations with, by, or for healthcare professionals. In this program, HFA medical consultant Dr. Hank Wilner will be speaking with Dr. Ira Byock, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. Dr. Byock has been involved in hospice and palliative care since 1978. He is a founder of a hospice home care program in Fresno, California, a past president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, and has published numerous articles on the ethics and practice of hospice, palliative, and end-of-life care. Byock's most recent book, The Best Care Possible, was published in spring 2012. HFA's medical consultant, Dr. Hank Wilner, initially certified in family practice in 1978, is board certified in hospice and palliative medicine, a clinical assistant professor of family practice both at Georgetown University Medical School and the Medical College of Virginia. He is a hospice medical director and palliative medicine physician consultant. As always, our guests' views do not necessarily reflect those of HFA. Now, Dr. Wilner.
Ira, one of the sources of confusion that many of my colleagues have is to try to understand the difference between palliative care and hospice. So I'm wondering if you could start off by telling us the difference.
From my perspective, palliative care is the discipline that hospice practices. But hospice is actually focused on delivering palliative care to people mostly in their homes and people who have acknowledged that they're in the last phase of life, that they're in fact dying. Palliative care, which grew from a hospice base in the United States, is also this team approach to patients and families with life-limiting or life-threatening, at least, illness that addresses physical, emotional, social, and even spiritual needs, and seeks to improve quality of life for the person with his or her family. That's exactly what hospice does for people who are dying, again, mostly at home, but increasingly also in long-term care and assisted living and sometimes in the hospital. In my practice, our team meets people where they are, often within the clinics of our academic medical center or in the intensive care unit when we're called, or on the cardiology floor, or in the ED, and we focus on people's well-being, their comfort and quality of life, but we often are helping people who are also concomitantly getting very aggressive treatments directed at their disease and intended to help them live longer.
Right, right. So as I know you've heard, people associate hospice and the term palliative care with death or imminent death. How do you introduce yourself in the hospital as part of the palliative care team?
You know, Hank, when I am called to see a patient these days, it's as a consultant, usually in the hospital. I do most of my clinical work in hospitalized patients. And I usually walk in, typically these days, with a resident or a fellow, and I simply say, hi, I'm Dr. Byock, and I'm with something called the palliative care team. We're here, our team focuses on people's comfort and quality of life, and we work alongside, you know, your oncologist or the cardiology team or the intensivists here in the ICU. And we just start in that way.
How do you coach your colleagues to introduce a palliative care consult into their care?
You know, at Dartmouth, we really have a wonderful relationship with the specialty teams, including the critical care teams and the oncologists. And we're often brought in increasingly early on in the care of somebody with a advanced life-limiting condition. And usually brought on as this is part of what we do here at Dartmouth. This is part of what we think the best care possible really is for you and your family. And it's important that we focus on, you know, your well-being, not just your injury or your illness.
So it's well integrated and well accepted.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're still growing. We don't have it completely right and figured out, but we've made huge strides. And that typical resistance that I'm used to, frankly, in the earlier stages of my career, as you know, Hank, I've been doing this for well over 30 years. but I know is still very much the part of the practice experience of palliative care and hospice physicians across the country, this sort of resistance and wondering, well, what are you doing here? And, you know, your being here seems like, you know, a statement that I'm not doing good enough. That's really history here, pretty much. And we work really as an interdisciplinary, collaborative set of teams focused on the best care for patients and families in these very difficult situations.
Well, it sounds like you've really advanced the light up there in Dartmouth. And many of us across the country still work somewhat in the dark, where people automatically associate hospice and palliative care with death. And in your upcoming book, The Best Care Possible, you're an obvious fan of hospice care, and you make the point that palliative care and hospice can actually promote and even extend life, which is a curious paradox for many. I'm wondering if you could discuss that.
I sure can. It's not a paradox at all, frankly. Our palliative care team is a team of well-experienced doctors and nurses, nurse practitioners, social workers, chaplains, who are, and others, by the way, who are really focused on giving quality care to patients who have usually multi-system organ, if not failure, organ assaults, and have a significant illness burden that takes a toll physically and emotionally, in really providing comprehensive care for their physical well-being, their symptoms and their nutrition and their functional status, their elimination. This is just the meticulous, grainy details of taking excellent care of people, as well as taking care of their emotional and social and even spiritual well-being and the assault that illness is on an individual person and family. All of that, it's not actually a mystery that people do a little better, that they feel a little stronger, that because they're more active and eating a little bit better, you know, they don't get to Cubidi quite as early or as often, and they maybe don't get to DVTs quite, you know, as often. All of that contributes to people living longer. It's really not a shock for those of us who do this work day in and day out. But as you know, studies have now started to show quite clearly that the survival advantage of concomitant palliative care with disease-modifying treatments like cancer care actually extends life. The seminal study has been by Temel and her group up in Mass General that showed that with people with advanced metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, their survival advantage was 2.7 months. I mean, that's right up there with Tarceva and Avastin, you know? But we don't cause diarrhea or rashes or bleeding, you know?
And not only potentially life extending, but enhancing of their quality of life, their decreased symptom burden, less depression. It's a real win for people involved in the care. So given those facts about how a well-functioning palliative care and hospice program might work, what are some of the barriers to referral to such programs, given their obvious benefit?
I want to address this in a couple of ways. Let me just say that I think physicians, ultimately, at the end of the day, are and need to be advocates for their patients. And we physicians have historically been prime advocates for the patients who we serve. In this day and age, there are barriers to getting the best care possible. And, you know, sometimes physicians worry that referring to hospice programs and even to, by inference, really, to palliative care programs represents to the patient and maybe to themselves a sense of giving up, of acknowledging that they can't extend the person's life. You know, the barrier to receiving hospice care along with disease-modifying treatments, be it ongoing late-stage chemotherapy or temozolomide for a glioblastoma for palliative purposes to slow the growth but not to cure it, or dobutamine or amiodarone in the home, or milrinone for late-stage congestive heart failure, or any of these things, that barrier is imposed by Medicare and Medicare regulations. It's not imposed by a principle of therapeutics or by any principle of ethics. At very least, Hospice programs in every community need to externalize the barrier. It's not us who is turning the patient down or can't admit the patient to full hospice services. It's Medicare that's forcing this.
What can we do about that?
I think we all need to work hard as advocates within our health systems, those of us who are hospice physicians within our programs, but also together within the organization of medicine, the associations, local and national, that we belong to, as well as individual citizens and leaders in our communities. We ought to speak out about this artificial barrier, this artificial division between palliative care and disease-modifying treatments needs to go away. We now know that there's neither sensitivity nor specificity to this notion that somehow people have to accept their dying and have this magical six-month prognosis in order to get hospice care. We know that concomitant hospice care and palliative care actually extend life, you know, and that's frankly that some disease-modifying treatments actually improve not only survival, but also comfort and quality of life. The division needs, you know, has already dissolved empirically, and it needs to dissolve in policy.
Yeah, I agree. It becomes a broader kind of political, social movement that we'll talk about later, hopefully.
But I think it's also a medical issue, because if we doctors knew of a treatment that could keep our patients with non-small cell lung cancer alive three or more months, you know, longer, and it wasn't available, we would rightly create a public outcry. And that hasn't happened.
Right. And hopefully now the data are accumulating to make it compelling to do so. And you would stress these points with the doctors in the community. And the problem also comes in the whole area of prognosis and when doctors will even think about hospice care. I know the median length of stay in many hospices is somewhere between 16 and 20 days, with the average length of stay somewhere between 70 and 80. And that speaks to late referrals.
Right. I'm somebody who continues to see patients who are undergoing treatment and hoping to live a bit longer. Is, you know, the main goals of care of patients I see is to accept medical treatment as long as it can meaningfully improve quality, length of life and quality of life, you know, length of life worth living. But they also then eventually want to die gently. And so I am actually frequently advocating for with the patient to get into hospice care as early as possible. But I also often have to work with the hospice program to craft a plan of hospice care that is consistent with the patient's goals. Sometimes that's the easiest when the patient isn't getting Medicare, when the patient actually has employer-based insurance. And we can work with the insurance company to provide full-service hospice care concomitant with, you know, their cardiology treatments or cancer treatments or whatever. And that works really well. And, you know, I'm sure you know, boy, that really is the best care for so many patients. But when not, we try creative ways of getting the patient the benefit in the best care possible. I actually go through some of the conversations that I have with patients around getting them to see that if they are too weak, too frail to get chemotherapy today, or in the they need to be able to gain 10 or 12 pounds and be able to get strong enough to walk into the office by themselves before it would be safe enough to give them another course of chemotherapy. Sometimes the best way, the best chance they have to reach that criteria and get the goal of having more treatment achieved is in fact to accept hospice care at home.
That is a novel and constructive and creative way to propose hospice care with a view towards extending life and the possibility of achieving different disease-modifying treatment later if they were to feel better. But at the same time, the way the benefit is structured, somebody has to certify to a short prognosis. And I wonder if you can comment on the so-called six-month requirement.
Prognosis is an inexact science, and it's often very difficult to say for sure. And I, you know, like everybody else, put caveats in place as I humbly try to estimate a person's prognosis. But it's often, for me, an exercise of getting a sense of multiple points in time. And in my mind's eye, and sometimes when I talk to patients, I actually, because I tend to talk with my hands anyway, you know, sort of put my hands in the air and put points on an imaginary graph. And I graph their weight and their energy as they have reported it to me over time, or as I have known them over time. And their appetite, their functional status, you know, how much they're doing for themselves, how active they are, what they're doing during their days. And often, if you can sort of map that out over a few weeks or at very least, but usually a few months, you can get a sense of the slope of the curve, understanding that at any point in time, people are far more risk of having a sudden stair step down than they are of having an improvement in a chronic progressive illness. You can, with caveats in place, get a sense of where their life expectancy may reside, a sort of a range of time. And I'll often use that quite sensitively in, you know, once I have a therapeutic rapport with patients, but I'll use that method of sort of graphing in midair their status over time to help us get a joint sense of how long they may have to live.
And through that kind of cautious and sensitive description of their functional decline, you impress upon them that their disease is serious and they need a lot of help and would benefit from it.
Well, my consistent focus is that I want to give them the best care possible. And,
sure.
You know, I titled the book that name, but because that's the phrase I often use with patients. I define it early on as, you know, being attentive not only to the treatment for your disease, but also to your comfort and your quality of life, your well-being, and the well-being, frankly, of your family. And so I've used that to emphasize that one size doesn't fit all, and the meaning of what the best care is today may be different than what it is in a month or two, and sometimes even in shorter periods of time. It will change as people's conditions change. But the best care, you know, it's not one size fits all, so it has to map and match their personal values and preferences to what's achievable in their health care.
And that entails a careful discussion of what the reasonable goals of their care would be. And I'm wondering how you help patients and families clarify their goals.
The way I begin a discussion of goal clarification, if you will, which is really one of the key interventions, or if you will, or procedures that we palliators bring to the clinical encounter. That's what we do, is clarify goals of care.
One of the major reasons we're asked to consult on patients.
Really, I think it's the most frequent reason that we're consulted. We do a lot of symptom management, of course, and we do a lot of counseling, which is another important part of what we do around, you know, adapting to the illness and coping with the stress and strains of illness and caregiving from the point of view of the family and work on life completion. All of that we do. But really, this clarifying goals of care is most often why we're asked to see patients, certainly in the hospital. My way of doing this then, and what I teach, frankly, residents and fellows, is I start by finding out who the person is as a person. My typical beginning of a consultation is to take the social history first. It's not all that long. It only takes about 5 or 7 minutes at the most. But I do it, and I'm going to chart it down into the body of the consult, just like everybody else does. But I start with the social history. I typically say, you know, I've just spent an hour or more going through all of your medical records, or usually Dr. Jones here, the resident who's with me today, and I have spent 45 minutes to an hour going through all of your records. And so we know a lot about the diagnoses that you have and the tests you had and the treatments you've been through. And might I say, boy, you've been through a lot, because if they're seeing us, typically they've been through a lot. But then I note that, you know, while we know a lot about the treatments you've been through and the complications and all that, we know very little. The chart doesn't give us any information about who you are as a person. And so I start there. I'll often say, before we start talking about some of the things that your oncologist or your cardiologist have asked us to meet with you to discuss and help you with, it would be really helpful to know a little bit about who you are. You know, where'd you grow up? And I just start there.
It's a very winning approach. Patients love it. I often have to ask the house staff and the attendings to be patient with it, because I think it's crucial to understanding where we're headed. So once you...
Well, can I add, it really starts the relationship within the context of a person's life, not within merely the context of this hospitalization or this complication of their illness or the illness itself. And in centering and sort of grounding the conversation and our nascent relationship in the context of a person's life, it's really helpful then when you move into, so, you know, what matters most in your life, you know, and getting a sense of when you think about the time ahead and knowing that this disease may not be curable, do you have a sense of what would be most important? All of that, or, you know, knowing how ill you currently are, have you thought about how this story ends?
It's a wonderful approach, and I think fundamentally it lets the patient and family know that you value and acknowledge them as a person and who they are.
Right.
So you start and you help to define what matters the most to them.
And then map that to what their goals are in terms of the available treatment options. And we're really quite pure about this in, you know, in our practice here at Dartmouth. Every week, there seems to be a patient or a few patients who, after our consultation, decide, sometimes with our help because it seems most consistent with their wishes, to go ahead and get more treatments than they thought they were going to. And that's, you know, that's just part of practicing the best care.
There are times, though, when I know you and your team run into situations where patients and families may be relentlessly pursuing life extension, and then you're called in to clarify the goals because the attending physicians can't make sense of what's happening. This is all in light of a glorification of technology and a tendency in perhaps to overtreat conditions. How do you deal with that issue? And I know that in your book you point out the interesting, to me, paradox, which is, I think you said to one of your patients, you may live longer if you decide to live with your cancer and not keep trying to fight against it.
Well, that's certainly true from time to time, isn't it? We meet people, it seems like, several times a day. Our team, myself certainly, and other members of our team are meeting patients who are in the predicament you describe. Life is precious, and people don't want to give it up. People don't want to die, understandably. And we don't want them to die, by the way, you know.
Right.
And their loved ones don't want them to die, so that they cling to life, and they understandably, both emotionally and often sometimes rationally, strive toward the most aggressive treatments to prolong life. That's a good thing, I think. But unfortunately, when someone we love is seriously ill and their life is threatened, or when we ourselves are seriously ill, any individual's life is threatened, the worst thing that anybody can imagine is that the person might die. But in fact, you know, we doctors know that there are worse things than having someone you love so much die. Most basically, there's having someone you love die badly.
How would you describe the typical bad death that we see a lot of in the hospital?
What we see is people, too often, we see people who are suffering as they die.
Right.
You know, we all celebrate, we doctors celebrate the advances in medical science and technology and our really remarkable power these days to keep people alive and so often to cure disease or to convert previously lethal diseases to chronic diseases. I celebrate it, and so does everybody else, you know, that I know of in medicine. But we haven't yet made even one person immortal.
Right.
You know, so that means that at some point in time, more treatment is not better care. We doctors really care about patients. I mean, in fact, you know, and doctors know that we get close to patients, and we don't want our patients to die. It's not okay.
Right. It's very sad.
It's very sad. And it's you know, our job is to try to help people deal with these illnesses and live as long as well as they can. But when I clarify goals of care, even for the persons who are most committed to any treatment that could possibly help them live longer, when I sit with them and after getting a sense of who they are as a person, I acknowledge, you know, that from what I can, I've been told from reading your chart and from talking to your, you know, your doctors, that you're somebody who wants any treatment that has any chance of helping them live longer. And people, you know, Mr. Edwards, I'm thinking of, said, yep,
right.
That's me, yep. Any treatment, I don't want to die, I'm going to beat this thing, doc. Well, my next question to him is, would it also be true to say that eventually, when your time does eventually come, that you want to die gently? You know, Hank, I have yet to have someone say no to that question.
Mm-hmm. You introduce the gently the reality that their disease may overcome them and their death may be approaching.
I want to clarify that at least in the abstract,
mm-hmm.
in addition to wanting to live as long as they meaningfully can and accept any treatment that has any meaningful chance of helping them live longer, that when their time comes, they do eventually want to die gently, because then we have a balance beam. You know, then we have two goals that we have to achieve. And I often will then say to people, so I'm with you, and I and our team will help you clarify and obtain any of these treatments that you decide make sense for you. But we also have to talk about and prepare for the eventuality of you eventually leaving this life. Because otherwise, if we don't do some talking and preparation, that other goal of eventually dying gently is at serious risk. And without conversation and planning, you're quite likely to end up in the hospital during the last days of life, and frankly, even in the ICU. And, you know, and if that's not part of your wishes, then we also have to discuss this. I have to tell you that for not all, but many pretty ardent patients who have repeatedly told doctors that they want every treatment possible, by acknowledging that yes, they do, but they also eventually want to die gently, I can then begin to have the conversation of what would need to be in place and what that would look like, where they would want to be, who they'd want to have nearby, who they would want to have spoken with, and all of the planning that we feel is important to frankly give them the best care possible, not in our terms, but in their terms.
That's a wonderful projected landscape for them to consider. And one of the questions I know you ask goes something like, do you think you would set any limitations on the treatment you might receive? Can you expand on that question? That's often a critical one for helping perhaps turn the ship in a slightly different direction.
When somebody is seriously ill, and during the larger goals of care discussion, I will often say, first, when you imagine yourself seriously ill and perhaps unable to speak for yourself at a future time, do you suppose that there are any limitations that you would want put in place, or you would want your family to put in place? Such as, you know, would you want to have a tube inserted if you were unable to breathe for yourself and be hooked up to a breathing machine? Would you want CPR performed?
You give them various scenarios with the likely potential benefits and downsides of each, I'm sure. It does raise the question about the advisability and even the efficacy of advanced directives. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that and how should people in general best prepare for a serious illness where they might not be able to communicate? And how can they try to assure that their wishes actually get honored?
I think advanced directives remain a very important tool. I know they're unpopular these days, and doctors particularly just hate them. And frankly, if anybody hates them worse than doctors, probably it's patients. but
what makes you say that? Is it the difficulty of bringing it up and introducing it?
Well, people just don't want to talk about them. They think if I bring up the importance of advance directive, or do you have an advance directive, a living will or a power of attorney for healthcare for you? Often people say, oh, I don't want to talk about that.
Or, they wince.
Or
yeah.
Or what do you mean? I don't think it's that serious, is it? For me, my response to that these days is twofold. The first thing I say is, this isn't about your prognosis or the seriousness of your illness. We do this for everyone. That's number one. And the second thing that I say is, I have an advance directive. And frankly, so does every adult in my family. I normalize it and take the tension away in that regard. If the physician can't say that, if the physician can't say, well, I just do this for everyone, I think it's part of the best standards of care, and then follow it with, I have an advance directive, it's a little bit like trying to do smoking cessation counseling if you're a heavy smoker.
Right, right.
You know, it doesn't work really well. You have to have done these things yourself. But then I think that advance directives are misunderstood by physicians and I think wrongly maligned, frankly. I think physicians think that they're supposed to be somehow plans of care in the future and to specifically sort of match the situation that they're eventually used in. And of course, that's never the case. It can't be. They're not prescriptions. They're not plans of care. They're not DNR orders. They're not comfort measure only orders. But what they are is a very well-constructed counseling tool that in the office or in a health maintenance visit or, you know, during the early consultations that you and I do, they're a way to help people sort through their thoughts and values and preferences related to situations that we all have been putting energy into not thinking about all of our lives. So having a counseling tool there, a form that actually delineates the elements of what people might want or might not want later is really valuable. Secondly, I actually emphasize to people that they are a way of helping your family at a future time when you might be seriously ill or injured and unable to speak for yourself, and your family is left to make those decisions with your doctors, decisions that are not going to be easy, that are going to feel burdensome. You can't stop that from happening. That's the way the world works. We doctors turn to family, the people you love most. But you can shoulder some of the burden by first giving them clear authority to speak for you so that no ethics committee or court or anybody else can question their authority. And secondly, by giving them a sense of what you think you would want in those circumstances, while making it clear to them that you trust whatever decision they come to. And that's why I have an advance directive.
Yeah, it really is a gift to relieve a very nebulous burden of decision making for the family when they may feel lost without the guidance.
I think so. And more than a few families have told me after the fact or after they've had to confront one of these decisions that it really was a lot easier because, thankfully, you know, their loved one had filled out such a form. They do work if they're utilized and understood by clinicians who see them as a counseling tool to support both patients before an illness or crisis occurs and family members who are, in fact, wrestling with these difficult decisions.
At least to start for the spirit or direction of a person's advance directive could be done in an office practice, couldn't it?
It certainly could and should be. If it's not already been done, I think it's just part of completing the health database, if you will, completing the basic information on any adult's chart, frankly. It's just part of good medical care. Now, advance directives don't have to be done, frankly, in doctor's offices. I'm a big proponent of having them done also with the help of people in senior centers or in faith communities.
Health fairs.
Right, right. In public libraries, at health fairs. I think that these things are personal documents. They're not medical documents. But they sure as hell are helpful to families who are wrestling with the most difficult medical decisions.
I'm always relieved to find a patient who has has one or at least tried to grapple with the issues. Ours is such a death-defying culture, it's very difficult for people to even discuss their death. And in fact, I wanted to ask you what makes people act as if they should be immortal? Because it's led you to say on a couple of occasions, we're all going to die, so let's accept it, get over with it, and move on. How do we engender more of a public discussion about end-of-life preferences and help people face their own mortality?
Well, you know, I would be a lousy salesman for mortality. You know, although right. I do this work, I'm a doctor, and I want people to live as long as possible. And, you know that a large part of my own clinical background is in emergency medicine. I really like saving lives, and I think that's what doctors are supposed to do. But as you just said, you know, none of us gets out of this one alive, and since we're not immortal, if we're going to give the best care to patients, we have to do so with eyes open through the end of people's lives. I refuse to apologize for mortality. You know, it's a given. It's a lot like gravity. You know, I'd like to stay aloft for a long time, and you know, people like to fly. I like to fly in airplanes, and I haven't been in a hot air balloon, but I'd love that too. But the longer you want to stay aloft, the more energy and expense and sometimes discomfort is entailed with staying aloft. And eventually, gravity will have its way with you. Mortality is a lot like that. We can keep people alive, but they gradually accumulate more burden of illness. And eventually, you know, they're going to die of something. Part of what I'm trying to do as a physician is to help people acknowledge and learn culturally that as much as we don't like the idea, in fact, it's unavoidable that death happens. And we got to get this right, too. You know, stronger. The only thing stronger than death is our love for one another.
Hmm.
And I include physicians in that, frankly.
Right.
And we must, if we love one another, we must take the best care possible of one another through the very end of this life.
And it's part of our mission, I think, in our field to help people define what life is worth preserving for them.
That's right. I do think this is the wizened physician in me talking, the person who has been doing this work for over 30 years, that the best counselor usually is the illness itself. What I mean by that is, you know, if with something like cancer, but also congestive heart failure or ALS or, you know, certainly Alzheimer's disease, that unfortunately the disease progressively saps people's strength and their quality of life, their illness burden increases such that at some point in time, the illness reinforces or carries the message that as precious as life is, the quality of life is eroding and may no longer be worth sustaining, or that a time will come when it's not worth sustaining.
Your palliative care team at Dartmouth, as it's constituted, is multidiscipline representation. And in fact, it seems to me that you provide hospice-like care in your hospital before patients can graduate into a hospice program if they live long enough. And it makes me wonder, does such a well-run palliative care program like yours constitute any sort of competition for local hospice programs in the community?
I don't think at all we are competition for local hospice programs. Quite the contrary. If anything, we're challenging the local hospice programs to accept and serve these patients a little earlier than they otherwise would. But to do so, we're challenging them to actually work with us when patients are in that transition phase. We all know the physician colleagues and nurse practitioner colleagues and nurses with whom I work all understand the hospice regulations. And we don't want to bankrupt the hospice programs for sure. We want them to thrive. But we are also really encouraging, on the one hand, patients to accept hospice care far earlier, but also on the other hand, hospice programs to accept patients who may still be getting, you know, I'm thinking of the patient with marrow failure who's got a good quality of life but still needs a unit or two of red cells every week or every other week. Well, some hospice programs just say no to that. we're trying to encourage them to say yes. And if it's financially feasible, and you know, if you lengthen the length of stay in hospice care because of the way hospice is reimbursed by Medicare on a per diem basis, the longer people are served by hospice care, the more treatments the hospice program can in fact absorb. So we're actually encouraging longer lengths of stay quite deliberately. Sometimes that comes, frankly, with extra expenses. But if it's consistent with their a patient's palliative plan of care, it simply means that the hospice programs need to flex and expand their own business model to serve these patients. When they do, it's a win-win.
I agree. I think some of the larger hospices are inviting patients in, even with some of these disease-modifying treatments, in the hopes that they can be both palliative and serve the goals of comprehensive comfort. And I know that your program works with the programs in the community because you talk about assuring that the plan of care is set up before the patients leave the hospital. I think it's a wonderful transition.
It's wonderful, but it's also, you know, a basic necessity because, as you know, that's where things go bump in the night. It's often in those transitions of care. We Americans don't do transitions of care for seriously ill patients very well. And so, you know, we're right now, as I speak, we're working on yet another revision of something we've called the hospice discharge checklist, just to get everything right, to make sure that the primary care physician's been notified and had a conversation, that the hospice team knows exactly what is happening with the patient today, that they're getting the discharge summary, that the prescriptions that are being written can actually be filled at the person's pharmacy, you know, that they don't get there and find out that, no, we don't have the high concentration morphine solution, or we don't have Ativan Intensol, or we don't have the Zofran ODT preparation, or whatever it is. Those details really make a big difference. And frankly, in a world we're moving toward of the accountable care organization, where the provider's organization bears some financial risk with the insurance company, this level of detail of really preventing crises before they occur is highly cost effective. It aligns the best quality care with also financial efficiency and value.
I noticed that you refer to a hospice SOS kit, and in the kit there are injectable medicines for urgent contingencies. And I'm wondering if that was difficult to set up in your community, because some hospices say that they cannot provide PRN injectable medicines in the home. How did you do that?
You know, it was easier than you might imagine. What we looked at was a few cases that where things had gone bump in the night, where people had people went home with hospice care and had, frankly, uncontrolled suffering. In one case, it was uncontrolled seizures with somebody dying of, you know, in the midst of status epilepticus because there wasn't medication in the home to control it. And another with severe dyspnea and just distress. And so we developed a kit with three parenteral medications, an opioid, either morphine injectable or hydromorphone injectable, haloperidol for nausea or agitated confusion, you know, and delirium, and a benzo, we like midazolam, which can be used IV or sub-Q for severe anxiety, but also mostly for seizures. And the kits cost about $70. In fact, we were able to show early on that they do prevent severe suffering and sometimes rehospitalization or emergency transports by ambulance of hospice patients who have otherwise uncontrolled symptoms. Our hospital, frankly, is absorbing the cost of these things.
Oh, the hospital helps set it up.
Yeah, nobody gets billed for this. The hospice doesn't get billed, the patient and family doesn't get billed, but we've shown that the return on investment is in the range of 30 to 1.
Wow.
Because you don't have to prevent too many ambulance transports or hospitalizations to pay for a lot of $70 kits in people's homes. It's our practice as physicians and nurse practitioners within Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. It's not the hospice's practice. the hospice programs weren't eager to embrace this initially. They're much more eager now, frankly, since they've seen it works and it's not, you know, it's not dangerous. But this is our practice. We wanted things in the home that could curtail any true symptomatic crisis. We wanted to control what we could control at home, but even if you couldn't control it and people still needed to be transferred, at least, you know, get the first couple of doses of medications that are needed in so that suffering is not quite so severe and sometimes the transports don't have to happen under lights and sirens.
So I wanted to change the focus to some issues concerning education and communication. You know that there are some basic palliative care skills to address symptoms of suffering in chronic illness. And I'm wondering what your advice would be for interested physicians to learn or enhance basic palliative care skills. When I'm asked that, we recommend the EPIC training courses, which require a commitment of, say, a weekend. And we're trying to interest physicians in learning more about basic symptom management skills. But
I do think that going away to a communication workshop is the best way to do this, because I actually think you have to role play it or use standardized patients. And really, to really teach it, physicians need to sort of feel the words coming out of their own mouths and get a sense of what that feels like in a practiced, at least, clinical situation.
Right. That's why the fellowships are so useful. But again, that's still a somewhat rarefied air. But that leads to a next fundamental question, which is, how do you train your students and fellows to be present and listen effectively with patients?
The cardinal principle of listening is that while you're doing it, you shouldn't be talking. And I don't mean that. I mean it to a certain extent tongue-in-cheek, but I also mean it literally. I was already a mature physician before I actually understood at a deeper level the value of simply being quiet and listening and observing with really more than just my ears what was happening when the patient was speaking. It's essential. Real communication is much more than just giving information. Real communication requires that the person that you're communicating with feel that they have been heard. You can give explanations and the right information about a person's condition or treatment options, but if you don't pause and allow people to feel heard, they're not going to feel satisfied. And frankly, from a conceptual perspective, one could argue that communication hasn't actually been complete. It hasn't, the transaction hasn't been complete. So I really teach and I model it, but I also sort of interview and debrief students and fellows after encounters about the value of the time that we weren't talking, the value of listening and taking a breath and not devaluing that time when there may be a silence. You may have to wait for the patient to feel comfortable enough to say something, but also what they say with their words as well as with their body language, their tone, their facial expression.
You mentioned a wonderful resource, a book by Bob Arnold and Anthony Bach and Tulsky called Mastering Communication with Seriously Ill Patients. It's just a phenomenal review of that. And
it's really a very good resource.
It's a terrific resource. And they also did a modeling of vignettes in their website called OncoTalk.
I was going to mention the OncoTalk website. It is a great resource. And they also do a weekend retreat up in Aspen, I think, every year. That's well worth attending.
You know, you've referred to gently coaching people through an awareness of their illness and the toll it's taken. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to judge a readiness to hear important news, or otherwise called, quote, bad news, unquote, but important news. How do you get a sense that people are ready to hear that?
I don't know that anybody's ever really ready to hear bad news, to tell you the truth. If we had to wait till we were ready, I think I, for one, would opt out.
So you might help create a readiness.
Right. I really try to counsel and support my patients and their families in a kind of a shoulder-to-shoulder motif. You know, I see ourselves on a journey that neither of us would have chosen.
Right.
And in walking that journey, I'm just trying to serve them as well as I can. One of my mantras is, I'm just here to serve.
Right.
So, again, I don't apologize for the bad news. I don't carry responsibility for it. In fact, the way I assess people's readiness often is I ask them how much they know and how much they want to know. And frankly, try to take my cues from them. If I do have to give bad news, I found it often helpful, and I'm speaking now as an old ER physician, to begin by telegraphing it. You know, I'll say something like, we've got some difficult things to discuss.
That's the warning shot.
I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. You're referring to a whole method of disclosing that's gentle and prepares people. And then in your listening to them, you empathize and reflect their feelings so that they really feel heard.
What the more learned communicators teach, and I think it's been helpful in my practices. I'm pretty strict with myself about this. I sit down to do this.
Yeah.
It makes a right. big difference. Again, that's something that I had heard earlier in my career, and frankly, I sort of dismissed. I couldn't imagine that it would be important. It's actually pretty important. And there's some, you know, neurological studies or neurolinguistic sorts of studies that strongly suggest that sitting and, if possible, slightly lower than the person's eyes really does make people more comfortable.
I agree. I think you and I learned that initially in family practice training with pediatrics.
Yep.
Always sit beneath their eye level because we seem less threatening. It's ironically true with adults too, isn't it?
It really is. And so I teach that. I model it for students and, you know, residents and fellows, and teach the theory of such as it is behind it. But they get to see that it works. And, you know, I have the privilege in our fellowship of sometimes having mid-career physicians as fellows who are retraining in palliative medicine. It's really fun to see them having been in practice for, you know, 10 or 15 years, now discover through our, you know, mentoring that these techniques make a big difference. It's really neat to see.
It's very rewarding, and they feel it too. They're very gratified. We notice that patients often try to protect their families, family members, not only from the so-called, quote, burden of their care, unquote, but also from the pain of their own illness. And I'm wondering how you approach that.
Well, you know, it's not uncommon that when I talk with people, they are distancing their families, interestingly. It's usually their adult children who they don't want to have bother. You know, they've got their own busy lives. The 82-year-old woman, this stuff happens day in and day out. I'm thinking of one, but, you know, don't bother my kids. They're in North Dakota, or you know, one's in North Dakota and one's in Ohio, and they're busy. They've got children. They've got their own grandchildren. You know, they've got their own health problems. They don't need this.
How do you get their permission to involve them?
Well, it depends, you know, on what level of rapport I have with the patient. But if I do have a rapport with the patient and we have some sense of a partnership in helping them through this very difficult time in life, I'll sometimes, frankly, I kibitz with them. I sometimes will gently tease patients. One of the ways I do that in this circumstance is to say, you know, I know you're worried about being a burden to your, you know, son and your daughter, and that they do indeed, I'm sure, have busy lives. But let me tell you, I've been doing this for a long time, and my strong sense is you already are a burden. That not telling them isn't really going to decrease their burden. They're already worried about you. One person gets a diagnosis in a family, but the whole family gets the illness. And I think that's true, you know, and I sometimes will say, you know, think about when your own parents were ill. Would you want to know, or did you want to know? Would it have been easier had you not known? We already carry one another within us. You know, I've been on both sides of this. It's important that During these most difficult times in the lives of individuals and families, the highest wisdom I've ever been able to glean is that it's best to do it together. You know, so don't set up barriers to the very connections that both of you need to get through this as well as possible. Not uncommonly, that counseling stance will work. Not always, but, you know, in just acknowledging that we already own this pain. Families can sometimes get past that sort of conspiracy of silence. We're not going to talk about it. Or this sense of, well, don't come because I don't want to burden you. And that just makes, you know, the adult child's suffering and worrying all the more painful.
And it's clear from your current book that you become personally quite involved with your patients. I mean, they become friends. You have a love for them, which is admirable and which we all should engender for our patients. I was wondering how you try to maintain boundaries around your doctoring.
I have actually very healthy boundaries around my doctoring. but I don't think that boundaries prevent you from entering authentic relationships with patients. You know, when I teach doctors, when I teach medical students and physicians in training, one of the things I emphasize is you really have to bring your whole self to the clinical encounter. For one thing, if you're trying to be sort of aloof and have this sort of, starchy kind of understanding of professional boundaries, for one thing, it's exhausting because you're constantly trying to be somebody else, this icon somehow of doctorness. It's much easier and much more refreshing to bring your whole self to the clinical encounter. I do maintain boundaries, but you know, the boundaries are reasonably simple. You know, we're not supposed to kill patients. Intentionally, at least. That's a clear historical boundary that comes from, you know, from those two tablets, that thou shalt not kill thing, number one, and then the Hippocratic Oath, and down through the AMA's judicial statements and our own palliative care principles. We're not supposed to, you know, shorten life by intention. That's a boundary. We're not supposed to sleep with patients. That's a boundary. But beyond that, you know, we're not supposed to make money outside of legitimate charges for our services. We're not supposed to, you know, lend or borrow money from patients and in that sort of situation, or do things, manipulate patients for our own personal aggrandizement. But that's pretty simple stuff to put aside. And absent those things, it is really okay to enter authentic relationships with people. And for me, that is, in fact, where a lot of the real soulful enjoyment of medicine comes. You have to enjoy working with people to get through the hard, really demanding parts of medicine. I find, and yes, you have to. You know, I always remind my students that we are here to serve. That's why we exist as doctors. So it's always about the well-being of the patient. But again, that doesn't disallow kibitzing with patients, teasing patients back and forth, bantering, and as well as being intensely sad at times with patients, acknowledging real affection that we have for one another. That's, to not acknowledge that is to ignore an inherent human drive that is, frankly, the impetus of healthcare and nursing care, medical care in its most pure form.
And I think at base it's really showing that we care, and it's very soulful work, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, the fact that doctors love their patients is actually entirely wholesome and pure. That's what professions are about too, by the way. We do have protection because we have, you know, gone through training, and we've made a professional commitment to only be of service to patients. But none of that I can ever find disallows warmth and genuine affection for patients.
I wanted to finish with just some of your comments on the bigger picture of our healthcare system. And you've described how we die as a public health crisis. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that and what changes needed to happen so that we could die well. I'll leave it.
Well, it's not an indictment on my part or an allegation on my part that Americans are not dying well. Too many people are dying badly,
right,
even with all of the advances that we've made in the last 20 or 30 years. Right now, still well over 50% of American deaths occur in hospitals. 20% of American deaths occur in ICUs. Very few people intend to die in an ICU or spend their last days there. 30 or 35% of people now live out their last days in nursing homes where, I don't know about you, but so many people tell me that they would rather be shot than end up in a nursing home. That's their worst fear, is not dying. It's really that we as doctors or their families will send them to a nursing home. Now, I'm not against nursing homes by any means, but all of that really points to the fact that we're not getting the best care by our own definition of it in so many instances. And we know that something like two-thirds of healthcare costs, what, $2.6 trillion a year in the United States. Two-thirds of healthcare costs happen during the last 2 years of life. Now, in one sense, that's because obviously people are sicker and are more in need of health services before they die, but it's still way disproportionate. And it really is driving the, what, 17% of GDP that healthcare currently conscripts from the economy. Even that would be defensible if we were getting good care for the money. But in fact, too many people are dying badly, often in discomfort, often having, you know, bankrupted their own finances, sometimes their families. We can do better than this. But we live in unprecedented times, and we have to think as a culture about what the best care really looks like collectively for all of us who happen to be mortal.
You've noticed that there is a financial disincentive to provide counseling, guidance, and discussions about some of the issues that might help make the care more humane. What can be done about that?
I think that the changes that are needed to align quality with the incentives for healthcare and providers like physicians are already being put in place, frankly. Whatever you think about the Healthcare Reform Act, Obamacare or RomneyCare, in fact, the entire system, including the private insurers, are already moving to an accountable care type model or a model in which providers, including, you know, health systems, medical centers, doctors, specialty clinics, a share financial risk with the payers, whether that's Medicare and Medicaid or the private insurers. And we're moving in that direction, which in fact is a good thing, because right now the incentives financially for the health system, including doctors, are to do more. It's volume and the number of charges that really underlie the practice's financial success. We need to move toward a system in which it's quality that really drives financial success. And to address quality, you have to address continuity of care and good communication and good transfers of care, good anticipatory planning and anticipatory guidance, and acknowledge, frankly, that, again, at some point in time, more treatment will not equal better care, because we have to plan for this time of life we call dying.
Right, and that is often viewed as a paradox with the glorification and exaltation of our technology and the automatic drive to sustain life almost no matter what the cost.
Well, it's assumed, again, that the worst thing possible is having someone you love die. It's important that our profession grow the rest of the way up, frankly, and help the culture, the people we serve, acknowledge that there are worse things than dying, on the one hand, and that it doesn't have to be as bad as we fear it is, that in fact it is unwanted, it is sad, but dying does not have to be full of suffering only and agony. It can, in fact, have its own poignancy and value. And as you know, sometimes it's a very, very rich time in the lives of individuals and the lives of families.
It's paradoxically rich, and it's also rich for us because as we ask patients and families what matters the most to them and what gives their life the most meaning, we can't help but ask ourselves the same questions.
This is a rich time of rich aspect of practice. Sort of the open secret among our team is that while so many of our colleagues in various medical specialties are feeling the strain and fatigue and frustrations of practicing in this current healthcare environment, we're all thriving and achieving or experiencing deep satisfaction in our clinical practices. This is a difficult part of medical practice. I think so many of our colleagues think it must be easy somehow to be doing this work, and it's not. It is a specialty, quite truly, but it's also a very, very satisfying part of practice. And I think that secret is gradually getting out and being acknowledged by many of our colleagues in different disciplines.
Well, I certainly agree. And so I wanted to ask, perhaps by virtue of a summary, is there any advice you'd give the physician in the community about improving the care of their patients at the end of their lives?
I think that our shared commitment, our historic commitment as physicians, is in fact to give the very best care possible to the people who are our patients. That is our calling. That is our commitment. That's what the profession is all about, to serve people as well as we can. We meet people often in difficult circumstances, and we walk with them through the most difficult of life's situations. I think that we all should reaffirm our commitment to give the best care possible. But since we live in unprecedented times, we live in times where people are living longer and living with illnesses that even 20 and 30 and certainly 50 years ago would frequently kill people. Now we've invented chronic illness. We also have to re-examine and rediscover, if you will, what the best care for people through the end of life looks like now in this unprecedented third millennium world where we have so many more new technologies and effective treatments to offer in even late-stage disease. That's a good thing that we need to celebrate. But we really all, starting with physicians, who are historic leaders in the realm of healthcare for society, we all have to decide for ourselves, frankly, what really is the best care through the end of life. I would assert that that involves hospice care and palliative care concurrent during disease treatments, and that it involves caring not only for the person's physical well-being, but for their emotional, social, spiritual well-being, and for the support for their families. I don't think everybody needs to have a palliative care consult. So much of what we do can be done by a general internist and family physicians, oncologists, cardiologists. But often we are there to provide value-added services, if you will, and helping to support people, to control symptoms, to clarify goals, and to support people through these very difficult times of life. Medicine remains the I think, highest calling and most valued profession. I think it's just part of fulfilling our responsibility, not only to society, but to the legacy of the profession we'll leave to the next generation, to help our society get this one right.
Well, Ira, I agree. I just want to say it's a privilege, really. Take care. Keep up the great work you're doing.
Thanks, Hank. It's good to talk with you.
I've been speaking with Dr. Ira Byock. I'm Dr. Hank Wilner for the Hospice Foundation of America.
This has been Hospice Foundation of America's Professionally Speaking, featuring conversations with, by, or for healthcare professionals. For more information, visit us online at hospicefoundation.org. Thanks for listening.